Hi, I'm Tess Vigeland, and this is the Marketplace Money Podcast for the weekend of June 25th, 2010. It has been almost 2 years since the U.S. financial system found itself on the brink of collapse. Since then, the economy spiraled into what we now call the Great Recession. The stock market fell down the rabbit hole and then bounced right back out. All the while, promises of reform burbled quietly in the background. And now, we have a compromise bill, what's being called the most significant overhaul of financial regulations since the Great Depression. It creates a Consumer Financial Protection Bureau within the Federal Reserve that will regulate everything from mortgages to credit cards to payday lenders. Another new agency has the authority to break up and liquidate banks that are in enough trouble to affect the entire economy. You will no longer be able to get a mortgage without showing that you can pay for it. There is a lot more, and here to discuss it with us is Congressman Barney Frank, the chair of the House Financial Services Committee. Thanks for being with us.
You're welcome.
This law is the direct outgrowth of the crisis of the fall of 2008. So let me ask you, if we had this law in place in June of 2008, 2 years ago this week, would we have avoided the meltdown?
We would have been able to deal with it better. It wouldn't have been quite as bad. If we had these laws in place in 2004 or 5, then we would have avoided it. By 2008, a lot of bad things had already happened, but we wouldn't have been able to avoid the meltdown. We would have been able to cope with it better. If an institution is in trouble, you put it out of business. There will be no more AIGs being kept alive while we have to pay off some of their debts. There will be death panels, but they won't be for old women. They'll be for financial institutions. Secondly, the federal government will be able to pick and choose and pay some of the expenses that result from these collapses, but not all of them. And they will do it, finally, not with any taxpayer money, but with money that's assessed on the financial institutions. So, good question. If we had that rule in June of 2008, we would have been able to mitigate the danger. If we had it in 2005, we would have been able to prevent the crisis.
Is this bill strong enough to prevent that from happening again?
Oh, without question. We can't say there won't be another crisis, obviously. But it is highly unlikely, very highly unlikely, that we'll have a crisis caused by the kinds of irresponsible actions that triggered the current one.
What do you think is missing that you were really hoping to see?
Well, I would have liked to go further in the Consumer Bureau. Its independence is a little compromised by the ability of the other federal regulators to, by two-thirds vote, override them. Otherwise, I would have liked to have a little bit more in which the financial institutions contributed to help cities deal with foreclosure-related blight and help unemployed people avoid foreclosure.
How do you think this will change how you interact as a consumer with the banking system?
First of all, we've already changed and protected people on credit cards. They will get more protection on credit cards from a Consumer Bureau. We passed a good law restricting some credit card abusive practices, but the banks were then free to go into new ones, and it takes us too long to pass another law.
Right.
With a in-place consumer agency, they won't be able to do that. They won't be able to do something new. They'll be hit again. Overdraft fees will undoubtedly be addressed. And the other thing is this, an investment advice, frankly, you asked me about me personally. I've got severe conflict of interest rules, so I am almost entirely invested personally in Massachusetts municipal bonds and double tax exempt, absolutely secure. And but if you do have a financial advisor, if you deal with a broker-dealer who is selling you products, they will now have a fiduciary responsibility, and that's very important. There will be fiduciary responsibilities on the people who are selling many of these products to individuals, and that's another area that we have, I think, improved consumer protection.
Undoubtedly, in a 2,000-page bill, the banking industry is probably going to find some loopholes. What are your major concerns about the financial industry trying to get around what you've done today?
That's a perfectly reasonable question, and we've anticipated it. We gave the regulators the power not simply to enforce the current set of regulations, but to impose new ones if that comes up. For the first time, every financial entity of any size in America will be covered by a regulator and will have to report to that regulator. And we give the regulators the power to step in if any institution or pattern of activities threatens a crisis. The regulators can step in with non-enumerated powers and say, all right, stop it. You got to knock this off. If there is a new activity that we hadn't thought of, the financial council, some regulator will be in charge of it. So we have given a residual power to the regulators to go beyond our specifics in case of exactly what you suggest.
Congressman Barney Frank, thank you so much for your time today.
My pleasure.
This bill, by the way, once signed, will be known as the Dodd-Frank Act for Congressman Frank and his Senate cohort, Christopher Dodd. The banking industry obviously has been watching this bill closely and lobbying. So we turn to Scott Talbot of the Financial Services Roundtable for some reaction. Thanks for joining us.
Sure, my pleasure.
We have a bill. Tell us what the banking system is for and against at this point.
We are for removing uncertainty. I mean, we have a new day here, and we have a new regulatory structure, which is stronger and better in most regards. We do have some concerns, obviously, a couple of the provisions, namely the Volcker provision as well as the derivatives provisions, will reduce the ability of the industry to lend and will reduce the industry's competitiveness on a global scale. And to a large extent, will reduce the bank's ability to help their customers manage their needs.
How does that happen? Explain to me how this bill reduces the ability of banks to lend.
The bill limits the ways in which a bank can generate revenue, so that makes the bank weaker. Secondly, it increases the capital requirements. And so while in general that's a good thing, some of these provisions we feel go a little too far. There's too much capital. And if the capital is sitting on the balance sheet, it's unable to be lent to customers for loans. And so it reduces the ability of the bank to lend.
I think a lot of consumers have watched what has happened over the last 2 years and said, look, the system how it was, where you had a lot of choice, where you could get a loan without proving that you had income, you know, that all got us into trouble in the first place.
So, could not agree more, and bad loans helped get us into this situation. And this bill requires banks to make good loans based on the borrower's ability to repay. We think that's the right standard, should have been in place a long time ago, and we support it going forward.
But what also got us into this trouble is that the banks couldn't bail themselves out because they didn't have enough cash on hand.
This is a delicate balance, though. You want to increase the capital to protect against the risks of the activities the banks engage in, but you don't want to have too much capital sitting there on the bank's balance sheets and not out lending.
Scott Talbot of the Financial Services Roundtable, thanks so much.
My pleasure. Thank you.
We have lots more coverage of the financial reform effort at marketplace.org. As oil continues to spew into the Gulf of Mexico, families along the coastline are reevaluating all of their assumptions about their financial lives. The Gulf provides many of them with two big economic opportunities, oil and fish. And right now, the futures of both are in question. From the Marketplace Sustainability Desk, Adrian Hill reports.
It's Sunday morning at Mount Olive Missionary Baptist Church, and the choir is keeping busy. The pastor had an earlier service in another town and is stuck in traffic, so they keep on circling through hymns till he gets here. When Pastor Theodore Turner does arrive, he performs three baptisms. Everyone prays, thanking God, and asking for his help getting through this oil spill.
As you probably can tell, that this isn't a very affluent neighborhood. There are no millionaires or billionaires or anything like that here. So we make it from day to day.
This is a part of Louisiana that's been through a lot. Hurricane Katrina hit it hard. Some people still live in trailers. There's no grocery store nearby anymore.
This is a fishing community in the middle of the oil field, and most persons primarily make their living by those two industries.
There's no better example than Janice and Rondi Andry, members of the Mount Olive congregation. They've been married a long time.
42 years.
She does the paperwork for an oil company. He's a commercial shrimper.
14, 16-hour days. When you're self-employed like that in that line of work, you take more than 8 to 10 hours. So when I'm on that water, it's a long day.
But Rondi isn't shrimping now. Most of the areas he fishes are closed. Together, they typically make about $50,000 a year, and right now they're getting by okay. Rondi got a check from BP, and BP is paying him to use his boat on the cleanup.
After this is all over, the cleanup is all over, what you gonna do? Like I say, 3 to 5, maybe 10 years, you can't shrimp. So what you gonna do?
Rondi's 61. He says he's too old to find other work. He'd like to retire, but...
I can't. Due to Katrina and now this oil spill, ain't no way I could retire. You know, if I want to survive, I got to keep working until I can't work no more.
From the outside, it seems surprising that fishermen wouldn't resent the oil industry, especially now that oil has pretty much destroyed the fishing. But Janice and Rondi say they only have one type of fight about their work. She doesn't like that he puts in such long days. There's no anger about the oil spill, no conflict.
The Gulf has more than one way for you to make a living. You know, you can either be in the oil industry in the Gulf, or you could be in the fishing, shrimping, you know, charter fishing industry in the Gulf. The Gulf is not limited to just one vocation or occupation.
Right.
Like a good marriage, the two industries depend on each other. The fishermen buy the diesel to power the boats, the rigs make reefs for fish, and the oil industry people buy seafood. They take charter fishing trips. Janice and Rondi both believe we have to keep drilling. And now that he's out of shrimping, Janice says they're depending on it. She wants President Obama to deal with BP, but not punish the whole industry.
If he halts drilling, then I can see gasoline going up to an ungodly amount that I can't afford. For two reasons, because the shrimping industry, which is part of my livelihood, is no longer, so there's no income coming in. And if he holds drilling, then I may lose my job.
The Andries are religious. They both trust that God will help them through this. But neither of them thinks what's coming will be easy. In Louisiana, I'm Adrienne Hill for Marketplace Money.
And it's time once again for your questions. Helping us out this week, once again, is David Lazarus of the Los Angeles Times. Hi, David.
Hi there.
You know, you recently wrote about debt settlement companies. What do you think people should know about these kinds of companies? Because you see them advertised everywhere.
I think the main thing you need to know is that there are good apples and bad apples out there. Now, the bad apples are very bad. They will charge money and not do anything for you. Here's the thing, though. The good apples will still charge you money up front and offer you no guarantee whatsoever of results. In other words, let's say you've got $100,000 in debt. Mm-hmm. They're going to charge you $20,000 just to take the case. And then if they can find some sort of solution, great. So when you talk to consumer advocates about this, they say, look, this is just not a business model that favors the consumer. And a much fairer model would be that they get paid on the back end based on their results. Needless to say, the industry doesn't like that idea because that would make them work for a living. So consumer advocates say, you know, you're probably going to be much better off going to a licensed credit counselor. They're not going to do away with your debt. They're going to restructure it. They're going to make it manageable. But at least you're going to know that you're going to get some results and probably no money out of pocket.
So is that maybe a buzzword that you should be looking for, the phrase debt settlement versus credit counseling?
Oh, absolutely. And also watch out for things like credit repair. That's another real creepy one, too. The ones that say, we know you've got a really lousy credit score now, but we can fix that. There is no alchemy that will do that. Credit repair can only be done by you being good with your credit, not by someone else stepping in and waving pixie dust over it.
All right. Well, Susan is on the line from Lincoln City, Oregon, one of my favorite beaches. Hi, Susan.
Hi, how are you?
Very well. And what station do you hear us on?
KOPB.
KOPB, the folks who gave me my very first job.
Oh, rock on.
I love them.
Well, yeah, and even though it rains up there all the time, good people.
Well, it makes it a very beautiful coastline.
Good place to work on your tan, though? Not so much.
Not so much.
Not so much.
And I know you're a nurse, but you and your husband are really into water sports, right?
Right, that's right. My husband is a surfboard maker and a kiteboard instructor.
Kiteboard. That's the one you're on a board. It's like wind surfing, but you're on a board and you're holding like a big old kite that's pulling you along, right?
Exactly, and it's the most fun I've ever had.
I don't know about that, David.
That doesn't sound like for me exactly. I always have these images of me just sort of sailing off towards the horizon.
You know, oh, no.
Dangling from the bar. You know?
Find yourself in Japan at some point.
Gone.
So you're into extreme sports, but you will also go to extreme measures to get a deal. Tell us what you've done in the past with airline miles.
I was at the post office, and this lady in front of me was buying money orders, and the postal employee asked her, well, what are you using this for? And she goes, well, with this debit card, you earn airline miles. And so she would pay her mortgage and her car payment with money orders. And so I went to my bank, opened a debit card. I would put $10,000 in this account, and then go to the post office, purchase $10,000 in money orders, and then turn around and go back to my bank and deposit the money right back into my account.
Oh, my goodness.
And would earn 5,000 airline miles.
Woo!
Well, I did this 20 times and earned 100,000 miles. I'm not breaking the rule. I'm following their rules, doing their thing. But is that ethical to push it to that point?
I don't know. I mean, David, the banks certainly do whatever they have to do to take advantage of the system. So why shouldn't we?
Couple of questions. Is it ethical? Well, of course it's ethical. You're up against banks. What do they know from ethics? So you're doing your thing. Is it illegal? No, it is not. Here's, though, what you want to keep in mind. A game like this will call attention to you. The authorities at some point will see all of this money going back and forth, and there's two things they're going to think. First of all, money laundering and drug dealing.
Yikes.
Yikes, exactly. And that's
Susan, you engaged in either of those?
Neither of those.
Okay.
But... Oh, but you wouldn't tell us on the air in any case, would you?
No, but I was investigated.
You were?
They did come to my house.
Oh, my goodness. Who came to your house?
It was a U.S. Postal marshal.
These guys aren't messing around. So clearly Susan came through the investigation okay. But here now a couple of things. She now has a file. You don't want that.
No.
Second of all, once investigators enter the picture, and they will when they're seeing these big transactions, $10,000 transactions on an almost daily basis, they're going to start pulling your credit file as part of their investigations. And then ding, 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 all of this starts mounting up on your credit score. Now, that's not to say, Susan, that your credit score just took a nosedive. But there is some activity there now, and you're putting your credit score on the line.
David, let me ask you this. I know that $10,000 is a benchmark for bank transactions, and that anything having to do with $10,000 or over is going to raise some sort of red flag somewhere.
Has to be scrutinized.
Yes. So if she did this at $8,000 a pop, would that make a difference?
My advice for something like this is moderation. If you want to game the system, and the system is there to be gamed, I mean, they're all but inviting an enterprising, mile-pursuing person to do this, then go for it, but not so much, because it's the guys who go for more than not so much who always get caught.
Was 100,000 miles worth having the postal investigator knock on your door?
Yeah, I learned a lot from them. I don't think really anything negative came from it.
No, but what about the trip? Did you go anywhere with the miles?
I actually did. I did go to Texas, and we took our elderly grandfather to go see his 10 grandchildren that live down there. So it worked out well and had a great trip.
Well, great call. Thanks so much for calling us.
All right. Well, thank you.
Bye-bye.
Okay, bye-bye.
Well, if you think you can game the system, or if you're just feeling like you've been played, do give us a call. The number is 877-275-6669. That's 877-ASK-MONEY, or you can always write us an email. You'll find the Getting Personal link at marketplace.org. David, you ever done anything like that?
Kiteboarding?
Yeah. Well, yes, number one, have you ever kiteboarded?
No, I have not. I've gone kayaking, though. That's about as thrill-seeking as I want to do.
And number two, have you ever done something like that with credit cards, trying to get miles? I know that people go crazy for miles.
When it comes to plastic, I'm an extremely conservative person. I'll use it for convenience. I never carry a balance. And the last thing I want to do is try and out-sopranos my bank, because I know that these guys have black belts in this sort of behavior.
It's the bank omerta.
Exactly. The last thing I want to do is come out and say that I'm going to muscle my bank. I can't play at their level. And so the idea that I'm going to outgame my bank, it just strikes me as nuts.
All right. Well, we've got Alan on the line from San Francisco. Hey, Alan.
Hey, how are you?
How do you usually catch the program?
I listen to the podcast.
And where do you find that again?
Marketplace.org.
Well done.
Oh,
well done.
Ding, 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 ding. We have a winner.
We've trained him correctly. So you're looking to go to med school pretty soon, right?
Yes. Yes, I'm currently in the process of applying.
What kind of doctor do you want to be?
I don't know, actually. I'm thinking about academic medicine, something along the lines of part research, part clinical.
Keep you in the laboratory and not in the exam room.
A little bit of both. I like to be, you know, a clinician in addition to research, so... We'll see. I mean, who knows what's going to happen when we actually go to school. So.
You looking forward to a whole bunch more school?
I mean, I've been out of school for 4 years, and I've been working, and I think
School
is a luxury. I realize that now, you know. You get to go and get spoon-fed information. It's quite a nice setup, I think.
Huh. Well, so you still have some souvenirs from your undergrad, right? Little bit of debt?
I wasn't very savvy with my loans, and And even though I only took out federal subsidized loans, I have about maybe $10,000 in debt.
You walked away actually pretty good.
Yeah, I mean, that's not too
a
bad.
A lot of people are carrying a lot more.
Yeah, I mean, but I went to a public school, so that's a lot for a public school. I had a lot of financial aid, and I wish I had listened to your program when I was an undergrad. I would have been a lot better at managing my money.
What do you think went through your mind when you first were taking on this debt?
That it was easy money.
Yeah.
I was told by my friends that, oh, it's subsidized. You know, you can lock in interest rates, and then later on, so long as you don't get any of the private loans that have variable interest rates.
Yeah.
And also in the back of my mind, I thought, you know, my education is really important. I'll take out some loans now, be a little bit more comfortable, gain a little bit of weight, and then, you know, do well in school because later on you'll get a better job or go into a better graduate school and then you'll pay it off. So
yeah,
it's an investment up front.
I think that's a very common calculation, David.
I think so.
I'm
going
to be able to pay this off because this degree is going to get me a great job where I can.
And it's not an unreasonable thing to say, I have no money now, but by investing in a new skill set, I will have piles of money down the road. And so what I'm doing is gambling that I'll get there. And since I believe in me, then why not? I don't think that's an unreasonable calculation at all.
And Ellen, do you have piles of money?
I worked for about 2.5 years, and I have about $8,000 saved up. And I anticipate that I'm going to have to spend about $4,000 with this whole process of flying to different schools around the United States. And whatever money I left over, I don't know whether or not I should invest it, if I should pay off my student loans, if the $10,000 seems like a drop in the bucket for the $70,000 a year I'm going to be taking out when I'm actually a medical student, or should I just have fun and blow it all because it's not going to matter? And so I guess that's sort of the heart of my question.
Wow, $70,000 a year to borrow from med school?
When it comes to debt, I take the words of Polonius from Hamlet very, very close to heart, and I say neither a borrower nor a lender be. Now, I would say, considering what Alan's about to get into with the tsunami of debt that's about to hit him, if it was me, I would wipe the slate clean. I would take care of any debt overhang at this point. If the choice was between get rid of the debt or party, I would go with get rid of the debt, to be honest. Start med school fresh, and then you'll have a better sense of how to manage, how to structure the debt that's going to be coming down the pike going forward, and you'll have probably fewer creditors knocking at your door in the future.
Yeah, and you'll have just that much less to pay off after you graduate from med school.
That's true, yeah.
But perhaps we should ask what kind of partying you were talking about doing with your extra $4,000.
Good point.
I'm not going to go down a mission and, like, you know, go to all the dive bars, but I was thinking about traveling, actually, because a lot of my friends who are in school, they said that this is part of the time of your life where you have the most flexibility. And I was thinking about traveling. I thought about Thailand, somewhere in the southeast.
What, you don't think 30-hour days as a physician is going to be fun?
Well, so what do you think you'll do?
I think I'm probably going to try to go on some vacation. May not be the most exuberant and spend the much, but I think I'm going to try to modulate my debt.
Yeah.
Can I sell you on the Oregon coast at all? There's been a lot of talk about that.
Yeah, maybe Lincoln City.
Or like a road trip, maybe. I don't know. We'll see.
There you go. That's not going to cost you $4,000.
I'd play it smart. I mean, go down to Carmel, go down to Monterey, go to the aquarium, you know, do what you got to do. But a trip to, say, Cabo San Lucas, I wouldn't, not before this. I would just kind of get your game face on and realize that you're about to get very serious with your life.
Right.
Well, good luck with the medical school interviews.
And thank you for taking my call.
Our pleasure.
Take care.
Bye-bye. All right, our next caller is Noel, and she is in Arlington, Virginia. And she's not looking to fund a trip, David. She's looking to potentially fund the very worst possible news, which would be some sort of catastrophe.
Uh-oh, heads up.
So, Noel, what kind of emergency are you worried about there in Arlington?
Well, of course, we've had the terrorist attacks on 9/11. Sometimes when we have hurricanes, it floods. And so I'm wondering if, in the case that banks and ATMs are shut down, how much cash should I have available?
This is a really good question. And, you know, I remember it came into play also during Hurricane Katrina because the banks there were flooded.
Yes.
People had absolutely no access. If, you know, they wanted to go to an ATM, well, you couldn't do it. So is there any sort of guidance on how much cash you should keep around? Because I certainly wouldn't want thousands lying around the house.
It's an excellent question. And most of us probably don't even think that far ahead when it comes to this. I mean, you're patting yourself on the back if you've got a quart of water set aside. So, Noah, let me ask you, what do you have set aside right now?
Well, right now, I have about a grand total of $50 stuck here and there.
You know what's interesting is you are par for the course. Most people tend to have, in terms of liquid cash in their purse, in their wallet, less than $100 at any given time. And so that's all of us we're talking about now.
Right.
And yet when you look at the various sites like FEMA or other, you know, emergency-related things, there is no specific number that's offered. So obviously there's no one-size-fits-all. I've got, I guess, two ways of looking at this. First of all, you anticipate the worst in the event of a disaster. And to my mind, that means you keep a few $100 around. Keeping thousands on hand seems like a waste of your money, and you're probably not going to need that unless it's just far worse than we ever thought. And if that's the case, I don't think money's your problem. At the same time, the banks have contingency plans. People in the financial service industry know that when the you-know-what hits the fan, they need to be able to step up. And so the ATMs might not come back online quickly, but I wouldn't be surprised if, say, a truck or a van representing your bank showed up in the neighborhood and started trying to allow at least access to savings accounts and other forms of liquid money that's available.
Should you be looking at a week's worth of being able to buy things or 2 weeks worth? I mean, is there any guideline there for how many days you should expect to not have access?
You know, it's always about an ounce of prevention. And the smart play here is, what do you need in advance? You need water, food, and then whatever medical supplies or anything else that you're going to need to get you over that hump. But that said, lead your life. I mean, you can't live your life as if the sky is going to fall on you at any moment. Just anticipate that you're going to have a need for certain things, if not cash, then other things. And that's always something to keep your eye on the ball with.
Well, Noel, that was a great question. Thanks for calling in with that. And I hope you get that emergency stash ready.
I will.
Okay.
And that's a doable amount to have, too.
Absolutely.
Thank you.
You bet. Thanks for the call.
Bye.
All right, well, natural disasters or financial disasters, if you've got questions about them, give us a call. The number is 877-275-6669. That's 877-ASK-MONEY. Or you can email your question with the Getting Personal link at marketplace.org. David Lazarus of the Los Angeles Times, thanks so much.
Time for me to buy some money orders. Oh, no, no.
And go kite surfing.
And go to med school. What the heck?
Yeah, good luck with that.
Full day.
And remember to check with your own financial expert before making any big money decisions. Starting Thursday, if you open a new bank account, you'll be asked a new question. Do you want the option of spending money you do not have? That's what overdraft protection is. Most customers have always had that option, even if they didn't know it. They would find out when a bank statement came with a $40 overdraft fee for the $4 coffee they bought with a debit card. That's about to change thanks to new rules from the Federal Reserve. Greg McBride of Bankrate.com explains.
If you're going to overdraw your account either with an ATM transaction or a point-of-sale debit card purchase, your financial institution has to have your consent in order to process that transaction and assess you with the overdraft fee. If you don't consent, then that transaction will be denied and you'll have to either walk away or resort to another payment method.
So for new customers, the choice comes July 1st. Existing bank customers will get a note in August asking if they want to opt in to overdraft coverage.
Putting that choice in the hands of the consumer where it belongs removes this concept of the gotcha fee, where somebody slides their debit card, doesn't realize the balance is as low as it is, and ends up paying a $35 fee as a result.
Of course, there is another cure for all the rage incited by overdraft fees. Keep track of your account balances. But if you do want the extra net, the banks are more than happy to provide it.
There's really not a need to opt in because chances are, even if you do overdraw your account, you have other payment options available. Nobody's really going to want to pay a $35 fee whenever they're buying a value meal at lunchtime. But if you're a few hundred miles from home and your car breaks down, you want to know whether or not you have other payment options or whether you want that overdraft protection on that debit card purchase.
Of course, most of us will end up paying more anyway. Because banks can no longer count on those overdraft fees, McBride says free checking accounts and other perks will be harder to come by.
So consumers are very likely to see higher balance requirements, monthly fees being instituted on accounts that were formerly free. But don't take it sitting down. Be proactive, shop around, smaller community banks, credit unions, and online banks will still be fertile ground for free checking accounts.
Greg McBride of Bankrate.com. It is not often on this program that we urge you to make large purchases on credit. But let me tell you, this is the time to get a mortgage. Rates bottomed out this week to the lowest they've been since bell bottoms, 1971. The average 30-year fixed is going for 4.69%. But for those who already have mortgages and want help modifying them, well, this week the government said its Home Affordable Modification Program, or HAMP, has only helped about 340,000 people. Marketplace's Stacey Vanek-Smith joins us to talk about this. Hey, Stacey.
Hi, Tess.
So this dropout problem is looking pretty bad at this point. Do we have any idea why folks are leaving it?
It is bad. More people have actually dropped out of the program than have gotten their loans modified.
Oh, that's not good.
No. There are a few things going on here. Some people are dropping out because they're losing their jobs. Other people are so far underwater that they just don't want to invest any more money in their homes. There are some problems, though, with the actual program itself. Here's 52-year-old Susan Warner from Brooklyn Center, Minnesota.
It was probably the most painful process I've ever gone through in my life.
I hear the start of a familiar horror story.
Oh, yes, you know it. Warner says she was on the phone with her bank every week. She kept talking to different people. She eventually did get a temporary reduction, but it was only a $60 reduction. And eventually she ended up being disqualified from the longer-term program because they said her debt-to-income ratio wasn't high enough.
It was kind of torturous to never know, you know, for months, even to make plans. And I thought I was ahead of the curve, you know, and then 4 months later, you're smack in it.
You know, Stacey, this is, I think, a very common experience for folks who are trying to get their mortgages modified. These stories come in over the transom, and they're all the same. You know, my bank doesn't know what it's doing, and it's taking me forever to get anything done, so I give up.
Yeah, HAMP has been notoriously disorganized. The process isn't streamlined, and it's not mandatory. The banks really don't have much of an incentive to put the systems in place to make this work.
Well, any success stories that you've heard?
Yes, we do have some success stories. I talked to 45-year-old Joanne Tazar. She lives in St. Paul. She was paying about $1,400 a month, and she got that down to just $900 a month. She actually says she was a little frustrated with the bad rap that the program's gotten because she says it helped her save her house.
We forget that there's thousands of people that it has helped. I still have a backyard for my grandkids to play in. I still have home base for all three of my grown kids. That's what it means to me.
Are there other options for people who are falling behind on their mortgages if they cannot get through the HAMP program or any other government assistance?
Yeah, there's another government program that's coming online in the fall. It's called the Principal Reduction Alternative, or PRA. It will actually reduce the principal on your mortgage, not just the monthly payments. So the loan will actually be reset down closer to the current value of the homes.
And that's something that economists have been pushing for quite a while.
Yes. And in fact, housing economist Christopher Thornburg thinks this program is actually going to work much better.
They're getting people back to a zero equity position as opposed to a negative equity position. It's a better program than what they just put into place.
It is going to be, though, first come, first serve, so people should be ready. If you're not eligible for PRA, sites like modifymymortgage.com can help you figure something else out, hopefully.
Stacey Vanek-Smith, thank you so much for helping us out today.
Thank you, Tess.
You know those mortgage rates I mentioned earlier? Well, apparently they are not enough to lure potential home buyers into the market. The government says sales of new homes fell 33% from April to May. Of course, April's figures got a boost from the much-hyped end of the federal tax credit. But signs of a housing comeback are decidedly mixed. So what's with all the construction going on around Phoenix? KJZZ's Peter O'Dowd has our report.
Finding cheap houses around here is sort of like finding beer at a baseball stadium. Last month, about 6,000 new foreclosures flooded the Phoenix market, but Cindy DiPamazio didn't bother looking at any of them. She and her husband went straight for a brand new house. And that made me ask the question, what were you thinking?
I guess we took a risk, but we felt that maybe now would be the opportune time to do it, because we figured we could only go up from here.
I met DiPamazio and her two young children in a community called Fulton Ranch. The developers started it just before the financial crisis hit. Then in 2009, the owner, Fulton Homes, went bankrupt. Prices in this neighborhood fell as much as 35%, which means DiPamazio's house was a steal.
It ended up working out for us. I think it was just fate. We ended up in the right place.
Cindy and her husband moved in October. They paid $360,000 for the four-bedroom house, and records show a similar foreclosure in the area would be around $55,000 cheaper today. But this neighborhood has waterfalls and bridges and man-made lakes. Cindy says it's a great place to raise two kids. Still, moving here was a little odd at first because, well, no one else lived nearby. It was
quiet. it was like we were out in, you know, on our own, like in a country house. But it was nice. It was a different feel for a little while.
Since then, she says the neighborhood has slowly filled in. She and her husband were able to customize with their own floors and other upgrades. Some homebuyers, like the DiPamazios, want to buy a new house from the get-go. But there's another reason why people avoid buying foreclosures, even if they are cheaper.
Oh, you'd walk in and everything was filthy, dirty, rotten. Everything was broken.
It's been a long year of house shopping for Jackie Londo.
There was going to be so much repair that I had to do. And, you know, being a single woman, I had to do it myself.
Londo had contracts on two short sales fall through. In that time, she says she toured at least 100 aesthetically challenged houses, each with a different ailment, missing cabinets, stolen stoves.
So it was just like, oh, I can't live in this. I just can't do it. So I'd go on to the next home and the next home, and each one was just like that. I mean, it was just horror.
At this point, Londo says she was beyond discouraged. And then, one day in March, she drove by a new subdivision called Nicholas Point in a Phoenix suburb.
You know, I went with my realtor that day, and I said, let's just stop in. You know, what can it hurt? I can just be told I can't afford it.
Nicholas Point was almost empty. Londo didn't know it yet, but she had found it in the midst of a mini resurgence for developers. Analysts predict local builders this year will seek 13,000 new home permits in the Phoenix area. That's a 50% jump compared to a year ago. Londo's builder, Meritage Homes, is among those trying to catch up, and they're courting buyers just like Londo. The company offered her a great deal, $200,000 for a home that would be ready in 30 days.
I could afford it. I just stood there, and I just couldn't believe it.
Best of all, everything was sparkly new.
There was not one glitch. It was the easiest thing I think I've ever done.
Because there are so many foreclosures in the Phoenix area, new home sales make up just a fraction of the market's activity. But developers are still building. I spoke to Dennis Webb. He's a VP at Fulton Homes, which built Cindy DiPamazio's house. And I asked him what he's thinking. He says in this part of the country, people still like to buy new.
You got to remember, the new homes have been tough for, we're on year five now. So there's a large demand.
And large incentives for buyers, too. Webb says Fulton Homes is offering more affordable products with cheap interest rates. And even though unemployment is through the roof and people are still losing their houses, Webb says there is another reason why developers are building.
Because they have the land and they have the plans in place. And we've set up our pricing so we're not making a ton of money, but we're not losing money. So this is what we do.
Fulton Homes is still in bankruptcy, but Webb says the company is making money. Builders like him say they're confident the number of foreclosures will continue to decline. Those properties will be slowly mopped up and new home prices will stabilize. For now, they say it feels like the industry is emerging from the weeds. Sounds like it, too. In Phoenix, I'm Peter O'Dowd for Marketplace Money.
The compromise financial reform bill features a big win by auto dealers. They will not be subject to oversight from the Consumer Financial Protection Agency. However, payday lenders will be. The folks who give you an advance on your paycheck and charge you triple-digit interest if you don't pay it back on time. And in Baltimore, a pilot program is underway that offers the convenience of a cash advance loan at a fraction of the price. Kathy Ducham has her story.
Daryl Witherspoon didn't lose his job. He didn't get sick. The thing that led him to take a loan from a payday lender?
Man, I mean, I could tell you it was a parking ticket. That's what it was.
Witherspoon has a steady job as a maintenance supervisor. He also has a checking account. but he was short of cash to pay that parking ticket and a few other unexpected things.
We didn't have no real heart tragedies or medical bills. This was just trying to make ends meet.
Witherspoon tells me about his money troubles on the front porch of the row house he rents. He says it took 3 to 4 years to dig out of the debt he racked up with cash advance loans. Last fall, he needed another lump sum to move here, a safer place for his wife and 3 grandkids. That's when he found out about a program called Borrow and Save.
I grabbed the number as soon as I seen it. I said, I can't believe this is happening because this is what I want. You know, it's way better than what the alternative was.
Witherspoon got a one-year, $1,000 loan at 8% interest. A comparable payday loan would cost 4 times as much and come due in just a couple weeks. The money comes from the FDIC and a group of Baltimore community banks. They want to help people who become dependent on payday loans get back into the financial mainstream.
Having somebody that had a little faith in us, we didn't have to have that fear of, couldn't we make this? And it made it easier.
There are other cities experimenting with payday loan alternatives. In fact, the FDIC just finished a pilot program with 30 community banks who are starting to offer affordable small-dollar loans. The takeaway from the study is that financial literacy is key to success. That's why the Borrow and Save program requires that people attend personal finance classes.
Just about everything in a credit report rides for 10 years. Bankruptcies ride for 10 years. Information rides for 10 years. Okay.
John Griffin is a financial counselor with Neighborhood Housing Services of Baltimore. The nonprofit manages the Borrow and Save program. Among his students this night, a single mom getting out of bankruptcy and a young professional thinking about buying a house.
Most people assume that someone else is in control of their economic situation when really they have a lot more control than they really know.
For Daryl Witherspoon, information was power. He learned the steps he could take to improve his credit score, things like negotiating payment plans with creditors. Witherspoon's biggest takeaway, it's not just payday lenders who profit from people with money woes.
Banks prey on you making a mistake. And, you know, as you do your normal duties, you're not really thinking about maybe coming $2 short off of your $1,000 deposit and then having to pay another $45.
Armed with that knowledge, Witherspoon signed up to direct deposit $40 from every paycheck into a savings account. But he hasn't managed to put away much because of some new unexpected medical expenses. It's the kind of setback credit counselors like John Griffin worry about. He says in the long term, people need to stop relying on credit to get by.
It has to change. It has to stop. If it doesn't stop, then we're going to raise a whole other generation of young people who are not going to understand the responsibilities of paying debts on time.
Daryl Witherspoon used his federal tax refund to pay off his loan from the Borrow and Save program in just 5 months. He says he's able to relax without that overhead debt.
We're just able to keep comfortable living standards, keep our refrigerator full.
And enjoy the little things, like watching one of his granddaughters graduate from elementary school. In Baltimore, I'm Kathy Duchamp for Marketplace Money.
It's probably not fair to call payday lenders scam artists. After all, you know up front that the loan is going to cost big bucks. With true scams, it's all about pulling the wool over your eyes. And in this great recession, it is easier than ever for desperate folks to fall for them. With us to talk scams, scammers, and the people they scam is Cheryl Harris. She writes about consumer finance for the Cleveland Plain Dealer. Nice to see you again.
Well, it's nice to be back. Thanks.
I hope this doesn't sound unduly harsh, but it is 2010. How are we still falling for these things?
Well, the fact is, there are some really low-hanging kind of scams that are obvious kinds of scams.
The Nigerian banker.
We've all heard of the Nigerian banker. But the fact is, the way these scams work, the way they're packaged, can be much more sophisticated.
Can you give us an example of that?
This is from one of my readers. She had a house and she was letting out a room. She heard from a woman who said she was in London. She said, oh, I'm coming to school in Cleveland. This room sounds perfect for me. There was a lot of back and forth emails. And the girl sent a deposit, check for the deposit, in the first few months of rent. And shortly after that, the girl contacted her back and said, my father has been in a terrible accident. I can't come to school anymore. I need that money back to help take care of him. Please keep the deposit please send me back my rent money. Well, what kind of human could hear a plea like that?
Of course.
And not do it. And lo and behold, the check turned out to be fake.
Uh-oh.
All of these scams have in common that you get a check and you're asked to deposit it. Any ordinary person thinks, when that money shows up in your bank account, the check has cleared.
Right.
That is not the case. What happens is the bank is responsible to get you your money within a certain amount of time, the money from your checks that you deposit.
Mm-hmm.
It meant they're coming up against their deadline, so they're making that money available to you. When they find out that check is counterfeit, they take the money back out of your account.
What kind of time frame are we talking about then? I mean, how long should you wait before finding out that that check actually did clear and was a valid check?
Wait 3 weeks, wait 4 weeks, wait a month. Sit on it. You have to make sure that you're going to be okay at the end of this.
I understand that also that this is not just a cautionary tale for individuals, but corporations can get caught up in these kinds of scams.
Yes, they can. And there are hundreds of law firms across the country.
Law firms?
You get an email from Asia and it says, we're a big company here. We do a lot of business with companies in the United States. And some of them are not paying us. So we would like to hire your firm to represent our interests there, collect our money. That's mm-hmm. a very typical scenario for a lot of different law firms. But they'll contact the law firm again and say, you know, one of the companies has actually agreed to go ahead and issue us a check. And since you're handling our interest there anyway, we're going to have them send it to you. You deduct your retainer, just wire us the rest at this bank. And I'm not talking little money either. I'm talking about $200,000, $300,000, $500,000. These are huge scams.
But it is the exact same scam as the woman with the sick father.
It's exactly. It's got the same markers. It's the email. It's from overseas. It's got a check attached. It's got this request that you wire the money back. Those four elements are the same in all of these.
I want to ask you real quickly about another common scam that happens, the work-at-home schemes. You'll see flyers on telephone poles. You'll see it advertised on the internet. And you think, you know what? Sounds easy. I need some money right now, so I'm going to go ahead and do it. What are those?
A lot of those are accounts processing scams.
What does that mean?
It means the old check scam that we just talked about.
It's wow.
They're being asked to become an agent of this overseas company in the United States, set up the bank account, receive checks from all over, deposit those, and then wire the proceeds over after they deduct their pay.
It sounds like I can't trust anybody.
You certainly have to be cautious about who you trust.
Cheryl Harris is the consumer columnist for the Cleveland Plain Dealer. Thanks so much for coming in.
Sure thing. Thank you so much.
And that's Marketplace Money for this week. Next time, if you thought subprime loans were bad, try subprime credit cards.
These are high interest rate cards with low balances that can really set a family up to fail.
Marketplace Money is produced by Deborah Clark with Stephen Hoffman and Laura Dine Million. Our technical director is Josh Rogerson. Our theme was composed by Mark Governor. The executive producer of the program is J.J. Yor. I'm Tess Vigeland. We'll see you next week.
There's a lot packed into an hour of Marketplace Money. Check it out again on our website at marketplace.org or take the show with you. Download the show by clicking on the subscribe to podcast link and never miss an episode again. Marketplace Money is supported by Putnam Investments, offering long-term investment strategies built on experience, discipline, and research. On the web at putnam.com/largecapequity. This is Putnam Today.
American Public Media.